If you go get an MBA in business, you're not going to learn the basics of how to make money. You're just not. You're going to learn mergers and acquisitions, and you're going to learn, you know, why Silicon Valley Bank, you know, went down. You're going to learn, you know, about first and second round funding of the. You know how many people actually get to that point? No, I mean hardly anybody. Mm-hmm. It's like 1%. So we don't actually learn how to run a business in school.
Hey, Don, it's a great honor to have you on the Craig Rush Show Leadership Podcast. How are you?
I'm wonderful. It's good to be with you.
Man, it is super exciting to me to introduce our leadership community to you. Not only are you a friend, but you're somebody that I admire and have learned so much from. And every time you write anything, I am quick. I would say to read it, but that'd be a lie. I'm quick to order the audio version of it and listen to it. And you've got a brand new book that's just released. The title of it is How to Grow Your Small Business.
That's right. Yeah, it just came out.
My problem is, though, you don't have a small business, though. You've grown all your small businesses to big businesses.
Well, it depends. You know, we all look at the other people who have a bigger one than us. So my business is, it's definitely grown, but I think small business is like the $250,000 to $100 million range. So that's most of us.
So you would know much better than I would. When people start businesses, I've always read that a certain percent of them don't make it. What does that look like today? It's the success to failure rate. It can be challenging starting businesses. Do you know what are the current studies saying?
It's dismal. It's dismal. Mm-hmm. So within a year, everybody who starts a business, 25% of those businesses will fail within 12 months, 45% within 5 years, and 65% within 10 years.
Wow.
So 65% within 10 years. Yeah, and there's 33 million small businesses in America. So the 33 million are the ones who've made it. But, you know, millions of people try to start one every year. 65% of those are going to fail. Mm-hmm. And then if you think about it, you know, entrepreneurialism and the small business, you know, sector is it's the backbone of our economy. It's, you know, 33 million people have small businesses. You know, if each of those are employing maybe an average of two, because there's a lot of solopreneurs in there, you're talking about 66 to 99 million people who depend on the success of small business. Mm-hmm. It's too big to fail.
It is.
And they're failing for the stupidest reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not like it's that hard. It's just that, not unlike me 10 years ago, nobody could tell us how to do it. If you go get an MBA in business, you're not going to learn the basics of how to make money. You're just not. You're going to learn mergers and acquisitions, and you're going to learn, you know, why Silicon Valley Bank, you know, went down. You're going to learn, you know, about first and second round funding of the. You know how many people actually get to that point? No, I mean hardly anybody. It's like 1%. So we don't actually learn how to run a business in school. And I wrote this book. You know, almost every book I've ever written is a book I wish I could hand myself 10 years ago, right? Because here's the stuff you figured out. And I actually have a mentor named Bill, and he scaled his father's company up into the multiple billions. And then he started mentoring these younger executives. Honestly, he started putting money into smaller business. Didn't put money into mine, but he was kind enough to kind of mentor me. And I will never, ever forget, it's about 8 years ago, standing in my driveway. I'd taken my business from $250,000 to $3.5 million. I was incredibly proud of it. That kind of money, having grown up poor, was astronomical to me. You know, here's this guy, he's a billionaire. And I said, I just made a passing comment. I said, man, I'd love to take it to $100 million. And the first time Bill, and we'd spent a lot of time together, the first time he maybe couldn't control his face, but it was very clear that he did not think I was going to go to $100 million.
Your mentor.
And I said, he did not. Yeah. And I said, Bill, shoot straight with me. He's about to get in his car. He said, okay. He took his glasses off and he said, Don, in order to get to $100 million, you're going to have to professionalize your operation. That's what he said. You're going to have to professionalize your operation. I'd never heard that before, but it rang incredibly true. And he said, your business is too dependent on you. Congrats on getting to $3.5 million. Love it. It's too dependent on you. If you leave, the business crashes. You've got to install systems and processes so that this thing runs like a dependable machine. And then I started looking around for a book that would help me do that, and really couldn't find anything. So I made about 500 mistakes professionalizing my operation, but I did six things right, and these are the six things that I put in the book. Since then, we're not at $100 million, but we have gone, this year we'll do about 17. And that was about 7 years ago that Bill said that to me. So, and then I've doubled four times and I'm trying to double again. I'm trying to get to, you know, 32, 34 million right in there. And it's all because of these basic systems and processes that I put in this book that I was able to do it.
So I've got about a million questions that just came to mind in that last little summary. What I want to do, I want to get to the six main lessons that you learned, and then I want to learn about the professionalization of it. But before we get there, I kind of want to go all the way back to the startup, because when you were talking about how many fail, I was kind of wondering, are these people unprepared? Is it wrong idea, wrong time, wrong place, wrong people? And you said there are about a million things. How many of these are salvageable, and what are the most common mistakes you see early on? And if that takes us into the six things, then let's go directly there now. But I can only imagine how many people right now are getting going and they're, you know, trying to write a business plan when they don't have the right people, or they're trying to find the right people when they don't have the right strategy, or they're not profitable, they don't have any systems yet. So walk us through the early stages.
Yeah.
What are the landmines and what do we do about it?
I have six frameworks and playbooks, three frameworks, three playbooks that you can install, and they're going to help you align your business around three economic objectives. They're going to help you clarify your marketing messages. They're helping you close sales, optimize your products, manage your people, and then manage your cash flow. Those are the six parts. But before we even get there, there's one that's more important than all six of them combined. And that is, you actually need to own your business. You need to own your business and you need to own your future. And this is how I discovered that, because it's not something that you can do with some paperwork where you file an LLC or something. That's not what I'm talking about when I say own it. I really mean psychologically, emotionally, it's yours. If this thing fails, it's your fault. I don't care that you can't blame anybody else. It is your fault if it fails. And you've got to get to that place where you own it. This happened to me. You know, as you know, I was a memoirist. I wrote Christian books, wrote a book called Blue Like Jazz. Blue Like Jazz spent 42 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. I probably, at the end of the day, made, you know, maybe a million, 1.2, 1.3 million in royalties off that book. And what I did with it, because I grew up poor, what I did with it is I said, Don, if this money is anywhere close, you're going to spend it. So what I did was I paid off my house.
Smart.
And I paid off, you know, I had a great house, paid off the house. And I think I had about $350,000 at the time paid off in the house. You know, it takes $700,000 to pay off $350,000. You're splitting it with the government. And then the rest of it, I don't know what I did. I blew it. And so, but I had that money. And I found another house in Portland, Oregon that I wanted to buy. So I sold my house. It happened to sell a lot quicker than I thought it would. Sitting on the money, go over to buy this other house, and the other house sold. So now I've got $350,000, and I don't know what to do with it, but the house I wanted sold. I didn't want a new house, but I wanted that house. So I thought, well, I'll put it into this short-term investment for 6 months, and you know, I'll make 5 or 6% over the next 6 months. A buddy of mine was doing something. I put $350,000 in, and one Monday morning woke up and it was gone. Every single penny was gone. Now, I was, you know, I wrote one book that took off. I'd written a couple books since. They had done well, but they had not done that. I was pretty convinced you're never going to see this kind of money again, period. And from now on, you're just a working man. Like, you won that lottery and you blew it and it's over. And that was such an emotionally debilitating, emasculating, painful, cry yourself to sleep at night season. There's about 2 weeks where I felt that way. Not only that, Craig, but the woman that you know, Betsy, who's now my wife, we had started dating about 3 weeks before then. So women, you know, I don't want to generalize, but women tend to be attracted to good looks. They tend to be attracted to intelligence. They are sometimes attracted to money. I only had one of those, and I'd lost it. So I got nothing. Betsy could care less. You know Betsy. Yeah. But at the same time, that was enough to make me say, never, ever again. You know, one, you're going to take ownership of this. You're not going to blame anybody. You made the investment. You made it. So this is on you. And then I said to my manager, I said, I love you, but I'm going to go on my own now and let my manager go, let my literary agent go. And my assistant was already leaving. She gave me like a 6-month notice. And so I had said, okay, well, I'm going to replace this person with somebody who can help me run a company. And I'm going to start a business and I'm going to get this money back. Mm-hmm. And I started like a conference business, and we've done all sorts of things. And as my business has grown, we've turned into a small business coaching business. That was a little over 10 years ago, wasn't that long ago. And today, my wife and I give away at least $350,000 every year to charity. And it's all because of that foundational understanding of I will control my future. And of course, I mean that reasonably, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to accept agency for what God has given me to steward. Mm-hmm. And that was the foundation that allowed me to start growing a business. What I was doing before was I was trusting my agent. I was trusting my speaker's bureau. Mm-hmm. I was trusting, which is fine. But really, if things didn't go well, it gave me an excuse. Mm-hmm. You know, well, my agent didn't negotiate a good of a deal, or, you know, or I let the publisher talk me into writing this book instead of this book. Instead of that, I was like, hey, no more excuses. You are in control of your future. If it goes poorly, it's you. If it goes well, it's you, but mm-hmm. you're the one in control. So that to me was the foundation. Mm-hmm. And then as an entrepreneur began a business, I happened to write a book about clarifying a marketing message. That book ended up selling a ton of copies, which got me a lot of consulting gigs. And then I started certifying marketers. And pretty soon, you know, a company started shaping up around me. Mm-hmm. And that's when Bill said, you're going to have to professionalize your operation. But the foundation for all of us has to be, dude, you own it. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you own it. You've got to own it. And no excuses. It's on you.
It's always been fascinating to me because I knew you first as an author, Blue Like Jazz. And then it seemed to me like you went for almost overnight. I'm an author. Now I started a business. Those don't typically complement each other. So when you started a business, you really wouldn't have had much experience, I'm assuming.
No. I had run a publishing company before I'd ever started as an author, but, you know, I was really making more editorial decisions as the head of a publishing company. Mm-hmm. It was really more of a literary position. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's literally just like The Power of Change, just like in your book. All I did was chase curiosity. Mm-hmm. And discovered, which was baffling to me, that I was actually good at business. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have ever thought I was good at business. I thought I was good at putting paragraphs together and writing literature. Mm-hmm. But the more I racked up a few wins, the more I was like, I kind of got a second, you know, nature of this. I would actually say I'm better at business now than I am at writing. But that was an identity shift, you know, and you talk about that in your book, how if you'd keep doing the same thing and you keep winning at it, your identity sort of shifts.
Can anyone become good at business?
Oof.
Hey, Craig here, and we know that the quality of your decisions will determine the quality of your life. The problem is a lot of us are not great decision makers. In episodes 145 and 147, we're learning the strategies for becoming strong, intentional decision makers. And we dig into delegating emotions, making mistakes, timing, and so much more. In fact, there's so much to learn about decision making that it doesn't fit into two episodes. To help you build a specific plan to grow in your decision making, I've created an extra exclusive teaching you can only get as a part of our leadership community. It's a bonus episode called Discover Your Decision Making Style, and it's only for those of you on our email list. Based on my research, there are 5 styles of decision making, and my goal is to help you identify your dominant style and build a game-changing plan for making great decisions. Get it free by going to life.church/decision style, life.church/decision style, and we'll help you get better at making decisions. Now, back to the episode.
I, you know, here's what you're asking me. If you throw anybody into the deep end, will they swim? Mm-hmm. Mostly. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think mostly. I think business is about more than anything else, and this is a very controversial statement, especially to your audience. Business is about economics. Mm-hmm. And so if you are somebody who thinks, look, if we just love people and care about people and don't think about profit, the business will do amazing. I don't agree with that. Mm-hmm. It might do amazing, But you have to understand this business is about making money. Mm-hmm. And of course, the love of money is the root of all evil. But money is not the root of all evil. Right. Love of money is the root of all evil. So you've got to understand how to manage it. Mm-hmm. And I would say anybody who understands, you know, what I say, the very first thing in the book I say is that your business should be aligned. Everybody who works for you or you as a solopreneur should have three economic objectives. In other words, literally, you should say, we're going to sell this many of this unit, this many of this unit, and this many of this unit. Mm-hmm. And that has to be, it's in my formula, it's actually in your mission statement. Mm-hmm. So you have to see this as an economic machine that exists to make money. Now, you can give all that money away. Mm-hmm. Betsy and I live off a small percentage. We literally transfer. I'm like the fifth or sixth highest paid person on my entire team. Now, we also get the profit of the company, but we invest the profit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we see it as a machine that makes money, and then we try to do good things with the money.
Right.
The people who aren't going to be able to swim in the deep end are people who don't understand running a business is an economic, mm-hmm. it's an economic undertaking.
Oh, you say that's going to be a controversial thought according with my community. And I would say I'm hoping to train our community that's not
to think that way.
It's not an unwise thought that in fact, if you want to look at it from a spiritual perspective in the Gospels in Matthew 25, Jesus was pretty proud of the person who took a few talents, put it to work, multiplied, and create more, and said that's, you know, applauded that person versus the one that didn't do anything with it. And if you're creating a profit, then you create jobs, and jobs, that's a good way to love people. And so
yeah.
I would
it
say
really is.
It is.
And there's a lot of people out there who have, and the reason I said it might be controversial, there's a lot of people out there who have a very negative mindset about money. They're anti-capitalist, mm-hmm. anti-money. And I would say to you, no, money is power. And if you have an anti-power mindset, that mm-hmm. is, you're not going to go take any power or earn any power, you are giving power away mm-hmm. to evil people. Because mm-hmm. they're always going to say, I want money. Mm-hmm. So if you're not out there competing, you're just seeding the market to people who are going to do bad things.
And there's a scarcity mindset too. If someone else has it, I don't, versus more of an idea that we can all create, add more value, create more profit, give more money away, which is what you're doing. So let's start with ownership. Like you really have to say, okay, this business is on me. No excuses. It's not about the market. I'm not going to be a victim.
That's right.
I'm going to own it. What comes next in the mindset? How are we thinking after that?
After you own it, you come up with your three economic objectives. Okay. And that's in the first, there's six chapters. They're long chapters, but there's six chapters in the book. The first one is you've got to align your team or yourself around three economic objectives. Now, you can have 20 economic objectives, but in your mission statement, I only want you to focus on three at a time because mm-hmm. the brain has trouble prioritizing more than three things.
So let's talk to nonprofits right now. We had a lot of people running nonprofits, and so the ultimate goal there is not to make a financial profit, but you have to have a working financial model or you don't have a nonprofit,
right.
Correct? So what would be, let's say we are creating a ministry home for people transitioning from drugs. How would we convert those three economic drivers to a nonprofit like that?
So let's say that your nonprofit had different ways or compartments of giving. You might say, look, we're going to add 100 people to our recurring donation fund mm-hmm. that funds all the administrative costs. So these people are not giving money to the actual house or any of that stuff. It's just a small group of influential folks who we really love who cover administration. Well, one of our economic objectives might be we're going to add 100 people to that at, you know, $200 a month. We're going to try to do that. I like 2 years, 24 months. So we're going to try to do that in the next 24 months. We're also going to build 4 new homes, mm-hmm. right? That might be one of your objectives. You know, and the other thing is we're going to pursue 10 more close relationships with high net worth individuals, mm-hmm. But we don't just want their money. We actually want them to also volunteer. So, you know, if I'm adding 100 people to cover my administrative costs, I'm raising money for 4 or 5 new houses, and I'm adding high net worth individuals, I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. I think where we get into trouble is when we say things like, well, we want to minister to 500 new people. Mm-hmm. We want to see 200 people take our, you know, addiction recovery pledge. We want to see, you know, whatever. And none of those are actually economic. Mm-hmm. that it's going to be really, really tough for you to build that organization because businesses and nonprofits both have something very similar in common. They eat cash. Yep. They eat lots of cash. Mm-hmm. And if you don't feed them, they tend to die.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of glad you're saying that because sometimes in our attempt just to have a pure heart, we might have an ineffective strategy and that robs us of being able to make a real difference. So I like the fact that you would come up with, this is kind of unapologetic. This is in the, we can't look at outcomes before we have the right economic inputs that enable us to do more. So I'm tracking with you. I've got to have a real ownership. I've got to have three economic drivers. And right. then I'm kind of, now what am I going to do? What do I do next?
Well, now you've got this mission that you're on. You're going to try to drive these three economic objectives. And the very next thing you've got to do is you've got to be able to talk about those objectives extremely clearly mm-hmm. so that everybody knows why they should either buy your products or donate to your cause. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to clarify your message. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to create three economic objectives in our mission. That's the leadership of our organization. Then our marketing is we're going to create a very clear message. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a book called Building a Story Brand, all about that particular
fantastic
framework.
Book. I want to just stop right now and say to anyone in our community that has not read Build a Story Brand, stop the car, order it right now. Fantastic book. And yeah, I'm not overselling this one. It's a fantastic book.
Well, I'm grateful for that. And I summarize that inside of this book. But then people have asked me for years, Don, can you take that marketing framework and apply it to sales? And so the next chapter, chapter three, is about sales. And the chapter on sales is really, it's a bit of a Trojan horse because it's actually a sales framework that you can use mm-hmm. in, you know, elevator pitches and talking points over lunch to give presentations, to write proposals. I just teach you to write an email. Mm-hmm. And I teach you to write a formulaic email that has five parts, and that's it. And if you write that email to your clients, if you write, say, if you use that formula five times, it'll totally change the way your brain works. It basically invites customers into a story. You'll love this, Craig. I was with, did this twice in the last month. The first time I was with a company called Calix. They're a broadband services company. They put 250 sales reps in a room in Las Vegas. And they said, Don, can you come in and speak to our, you know, be one of our keynote speakers to our sales conference. So I went in. And I said, hey, you know, 250 people in the room, raise your hand if you got a sale hanging. Like it's just dangling, you're trying to close it. 250 hands goes up. That's mm-hmm. that's what they do. And I said, okay, let's write them an email right now. Like if you got a computer on you, open it up. We're going to send them an email. We're going to close the deal right now. Put the formula up on the screen, walk them through to how to write this email. And I had to catch a flight, you know, so I walk up the stage. The chief revenue officer says, thanks so much. That was really fun. Everybody claps. I'm out of the room. Guy calls me next day. He says, so far, we've closed $2.4 million in sales.
Man, I hope they paid you well for that. I hope they paid you really, really well for that event.
Well, maybe realize I wasn't charging enough. Yeah. But it was, you know, I'll tell you what, it's not coercive. It's not manipulative. The problem with most of our sales techniques is we're trying to talk somebody into buying something they don't want. Mm-hmm. And if you have that view of sales, you're going to hate sales. But if you actually have a more of a listener perspective on sales, we're trying to realize, wait a second, what problem do they have? Yep. And then how does my product solve that problem? And then how can I communicate how my product solves that problem in such a way they understand? If you do that, they tend to pull out their credit card and buy something.
So I wouldn't do this to anybody else because I don't think anybody else could handle a question like this on their feet like you can, but I know you can. So let's go with the nonprofit ministry home. And so we're going to learn how to pitch it. Am I pitching the person who needs it or am I pitching the donor? What's the first thought that comes to your mind?
You can actually do either.
Okay.
So let me give you an example. Let's say I'm writing this email. You want to start with the problem. And so you want to say something like, you've likely heard in the news, you've read it on your news feed, and you maybe even have friends who whose lives have been destroyed by addiction. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous problem. It's a painful problem. It's a difficult problem to solve. However, for everybody who comes to our program, that is literally 97%, mm-hmm. we've solved this problem. If you are looking for somebody to partner with to solve this problem right here in our community, you can give to this. Mm-hmm. Now, what I just did, here's what I did. I position the problem first. Mm-hmm. I position the product or the service as the solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. And then there's three more things you want to do. You want to give them a three-step plan. So, for instance, if you give us a monthly gift of more than $250, we will then buy a new home in which people go through our six-month program. Mm-hmm. So you're giving them three steps that they can take in order to solve this problem. The next thing you want to do in that email is you want to paint a picture of what happens if you don't give the money. Mm-hmm. If you choose not to give us $250 a month, that means two more people will not be able to enjoy these services. And by the way, there's a waiting list, right? But if you do, two more human beings will 6 months from now no longer be addicts. They'll be able to go back to their family. Mm-hmm. They'll be good moms, good dads, you know, and we will keep up with them forevermore. Mm-hmm. And they will spread the word. And then finally, the last thing you want to do is say, give today. Mm-hmm. So here's a link and you can give today. Mm-hmm. So let me walk you through it. You start with a problem, mm-hmm. position your product as the solution to the problem, paint a three-step bridge from the problem to the solution, three steps that you can take. Negative consequences of not buying the product, positive consequences of buying the product, and then a very clear and direct call to action. Mm-hmm. If you do those five things, I consider the negative and positive consequences one. If you do those five things in a formula and you write that as an email, your close rate on that email is going to improve dramatically.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you a question. My dream is I help shape Leadership Conference. What I want to do is I actually want you to come as a guest sometime. Then what I want to do is I want to take a random business person that you've never met, and I want them to give you their problem, because you do this on your podcast all the time, and then I want you to give them advice. And then what I want to do is I want to sit there afterwards after you. It's almost like a magic trick, like you'll wow people with the advice. I don't know how you simplify it. Then I want to ask you questions about how did you get there. And that's what I want to try to do right now. In my opinion, one of the things that make you so brilliant is you look at massive, complicated things and you see four steps, you see three steps, you can create clarity. When you're starting a business, when you're scaling it up, when you hit white waters, when you have a bad culture, how do you analyze a very complicated problem and crystallize a clear solution that is actionable and effective? What goes through your mind?
Well, a lot of times you'll meet somebody, and I meet these people occasionally, and you'll think, boy, that person is just a savant. They're a business savant, you know, in the world of business. Really, what often is happening with that person is they are actually just comparing what they're looking at to a standard. Mm-hmm. And they're able to very quickly differentiate between what they're looking at and what the standard should be. So when I look at a business, and you're going to love this because you're an amateur pilot, when I look at a business, I look at it and I'm looking for an airplane. Mm-hmm. And here's what I mean. I'm looking at the cockpit to make sure that they are entering into the flight computer economic objectives. Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't do that, then that plane doesn't know where it's going.
Yep.
And nothing's going to work. Then I look at the right engine, which is the marketing engine. You've got to fire up that marketing engine to get the plane moving forward. You've got to fire up that thrust. So now I'm looking at their website. Is their website confusing? Mm-hmm. Can people understand pretty quickly what mm-hmm. problem they solve? If mm-hmm. they can't, we can fix that. We can fix that right engine. Mm-hmm. Then I look at their sales engine. And their sales engine is, are you inviting customers into a story? Are you using this framework? Are you making it super clear? Do your salespeople like to sell, or are they being coercive? We fix that left engine. The wings of the airplane are your products. Your mm-hmm. products need to be very profitable, mm-hmm. and they need to be in demand. And we can optimize those products to make them even better. Mm-hmm. Then the body of your airplane is your overhead. And your overhead is your biggest part of overhead is always labor. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not running a management and operation system, your labor's probably really bloated mm-hmm. and your plane's going to go down. Mm-hmm. Then finally, your fuel tank is your cash flow. Mm-hmm. If you run out of cash, you're going to crash. So I believe more than 90% of businesses fail because of one of six reasons. Mm-hmm. And it's the six that I just gave you. Mm-hmm. So let's say I'm walking into a business and it's funded by private equity. They just got their third round or whatever. They're sitting on $20 million in their bank account. And they've got an office in the nicest part of town with the nice furniture. They're taking me back into a little room saying, Don, pick out any sweatshirts you want with our logo on it. Pick out any. Here's some M&Ms that have our logo on it. What am I looking at? I'm looking at an airplane with a big old fat giant body, tiny little wings, teeny little engines that are smoking, and nothing entered into the flight computer. I give this business 6 months, right? But if I walk into a business and it's a warehouse and they're sitting on apple crates and they got $20 million in funding and they're like, look, we don't want to spend any money on furniture. We're going to put it all into the product because we want our profit margins north of 50%. You know what I say? Can I invest? Right? So you got to know when you walk into the room where they're putting money. You know, is it, is the money going toward profitable products? Is the money, we waste so much money trying to look successful. It just doesn't work.
Well, and then when you are successful, 10 years later, you do start spending the money on some of the stupid things, and it's hard to keep that entrepreneurial mindset, and you get fat, slow.
It's hard to keep that airplane lean.
It is. And we're 27 years into leading the church here. We were the leanest, most aggressive, fast-moving group of people that I'd ever been a part of, and we're not as much today. It's more complicated, it's slower, and it's frustrating. You have to fight for that. And that's that. If we can take that part and go to the professionalization part, you've gone from 3.5 million to 17 million in revenue. You've doubled. Outside of those six incredibly important fundamental qualities that we need, how do you think about starting to scale up? What changes in your mindset do you think bigger in those six areas? Do you think different? What goes through your mind?
Whenever we make a spending decision, I go back to the airplane. So let's say that we're about to hire, you know, my team comes to me and says, hey, we need some project managers in these three different departments, three project managers. Well, I know that, that's going to make the body of the airplane bigger. And so what I want to do is I want to sit down and say, hey, we can make the body of the airplane bigger, but only if we make the wings bigger and the engines more powerful. So how do we offset this administrative cost? And they say, well, and, you know, and they come back to me and say, well, what if we create this new product that'll make us enough money to cover the project manager salary? Okay, well, that sounds good. So you can the airplane can go from a single prop, you know, ultralight, if you know, running on a rubber band. You just want you always want to build everything in proportion. If we're going to spend more money, the wings either need to be bigger or the engines need to be more powerful. So you want to just keep everything always in proportion as you build the business. And if you do that, you can get as big as you want. You'll never go down.
Yeah, that's really wise. I think a lot of times what happens in like in the nonprofit or in church world, I talk about it as above the line, below the line. So if you're trying to make the line go up and to the right, you've got to have what above the line is going to be your evangelistic thrust or your big youth group, or it's the thing that's exciting. The below the line has to be the cash flow, has to be the structure, has to be the admin. In order for the line to go up, the structure or that which fuels it has to be strong underneath it. And those have to be working together, or eventually the line falls and the bridge collapses. So I think your analogy is actually much more adaptable than that and more robust. I want to help people find you. The book is How to Grow Your Small Business. Can you tell us about your podcast, about your website? There will be people. What do you offer that we've got business leaders and even people nonprofit may want to learn from you? Tell us where we can find you.
Well, we're excited about an initiative we're doing now called Small Business Flight School. It's something that launches in May. It is a cohort of small business owners. It's a six-month program. And the challenge to every one of them is double your revenue in 6 months. So if you're a $300,000 business, we want you at $600,000 in 6 months. If you're $3 million, we want it at $6 million. It gets harder the bigger you get, but you can still do a 30, 40, 60% increase in revenue. And you're going to do that by doing everything that you and I just talked about. We are going to overhaul six parts of your business, and we're going to do it in 6 months. So if you go to Small Business Flight School, you can find out more about that program. It's just a wait list right now. We launch it in May.
And the new book is out.
How to Grow Your Small Business is available everywhere.
And if people want to come and find you, what's the best place to find Don Miller?
Well, if you want to find pictures of my wife, my unbelievably cute daughter, and my dog, go to Donald Miller on Instagram. And every once in a while, I'll tell a really, really bad dad joke.
And if you keep it up, you're getting a new rower. And before long, you might be showing some like rowing action shots, huh?
That's where the plane crashes right there, Craig.
That we just didn't put enough fuel in that. Yeah, the
staying kind of to my leadership and fitness mentor. His name is Craig Rochelle.
Yeah, let's go, man. Let's go. I learn from you every time, and I appreciate you being with us. The book, How to Grow Your Small Business, anything by Don, you'll want to pick up. Be sure and follow him. I promise you, he'll change the way you think. I always tell people, don't try to copy what people do because you can't, but learn how they think. This is a guy that you want to learn how they think. And I want to say to all of you, thank you for being a part of our leadership community. You will want to get the show notes. Go to life.church/leadership podcast. We'll link to all of Don's books. We'll link to where you can find him as well, with detailed questions in here to go over with your team. Post on social media. If you post and tag Don or tag me, our teams may repost you. And hey, keep growing. Keep that airplane in the air. Let the wings grow. Keep both engines going. Keep fuel in there. Make sure the cockpit is organized and pressed direct to, and tell where we're going with the economic drivers. And you will get better in your leadership. And we know that everyone wins when the leader gets better. Thanks so much, Don.